Psychoanalysis is a translation, traditore, of what I call in Spanish, psychoanalysis criollo, which means that we are hybrid cultures in Latin America, and that is something that we should never forget, because we've been acting in the psychoanalytical societies for so long as if we were living in some big modern city of the first world, you know, London, Paris, San Francisco, New York. And I think disregarding, ignoring, or even in denial of the fact that we are not there, that we live in societies which are in many, many ways different from the societies of the first world, and that we have to take that into account.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking, not only to their offices, but also off the couch, in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully, the worst is over, and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful. And I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Jorge Bruce. Jorge Bruce is a psychoanalyst in Lima, Peru. And he is best known for what he calls hybrid psychoanalysis, that is, the integration of a cultural awareness with a clinical understanding of how psychoanalysis is practiced. And we unpack both of those aspects, what's meant by an awareness of the cultural factors in the world we live in, and how one can usefully bring that to understanding the relationship with a patient, and how that can deepen the experience between the two people. Jorge Bruce is a prolific writer. He has written many books, published in many languages. He's a member of the Peruvian Society for Psychoanalysis. And most significantly, he's a weekly columnist of the national newspaper La Republica. And he has been a columnist in newspapers for 28 years weekly. He also has a Twitter account with over 330,000 followers. And the account is in the show notes if you want to join that list of people. I have. He is a former member of the IPA Executive Committee, a former chair of CAPSA, former chair of the Scientific Committee for the IPA Congress on the Infantile, and he is a chair of the Liaison Committee of a Mexican Provisional Society, ING. We have what I think is a fascinating conversation, because we really try to dig deep into the meaning of appreciating the culture in which we all live and the meaning of how that lives in the dyad and how one can address that. We also spent time with his sharing his personal story, his childhood, where he grew up, and the influences it has had on him. It's you really get to know the man, and it's worthwhile, I thought. Here's my conversation with Jorge Bruce.
Hello,
Jorge, welcome to the podcast. So glad you're here today. Jorge, you have this idea that you call hybrid psychoanalysis. And you explain that as being the idea that it is a psychoanalysis by Latin Americans and for Latin Americans. You say, if we are not capable of addressing our essential issues as societies from the third world, we will keep on doing a fine job as practitioners, but disregarding the soul of our social links and the way it models us as human beings. Close quote. Now, you and I are going to spend some time unpacking what that distinction you make is, fine job as practitioners, as opposed to or alongside of attending to the soul of our social links. But I want to quickly add, because you quickly add, that this is not about a grudge against either European or American thinking. You're quick to add that you lived in Paris for many years, you received your master's degree at the Sorbonne, and you had analysis there with André Green. Your focus, as you describe it, is to build a psychoanalysis that belongs to our history and our main troubles and suffering. The our, in this case, refer to Latin America. I'm going to invite you in a moment to elaborate on your thinking, and it will lead us into clinical material, where we will spend some time understanding that distinction you make between the practice of psychoanalysis and the social awareness and involvement in psychoanalysis. This podcast, after all, is called On and Off the Couch. It's not one or the other, it's both. I do want to add, though, that a colleague of yours mentioned your name to me, and he characterized you as a master of Twitter. Brought a smile to my face. You'll tell us, an enormous number of Twitter followers. But more importantly, perhaps, you are a newspaper columnist for 28 years, I think, writing a weekly column and sharing in that way a psychoanalytic sensibility with the community at large. Let's start off, though, with your concept of hybrid psychoanalysis, and we'll go from there.
Okay, Harvey, thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me to your podcast and giving me this wonderful occasion to discuss my ideas with you. Because I'm sure this is going to help me a lot to think about what I think, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Thank you to your questions, your reading, and your sharp questioning. We've been talking a little bit before, so I know what's going on here, and I'm glad about that. Yes, hybrid psychoanalysis is a translation, traductore, traditore, of what I call in Spanish psychoanalysis criollo, which means that we are hybrid cultures in Latin America, and that is something that we should never forget, because we've been acting in the psychoanalytical societies for so long as if we were living in some big modern city of the first world, you know, London, Paris, San Francisco, New York. And I think disregarding, ignoring, or even in denial of the fact that we are not there, that we live in societies which are in many, many ways different from the societies of the first world, and that we have to take that into account. This is, of course, not only true for Latin America, but Latin America is my region. That's the place I know better. It's true, I lived many years in Europe, but in the psychoanalytical world, I've been mainly in many, many different places in Latin America because of my official post or because of invitations in the IPA. So I think we cannot continue to be in this, maybe this is a very, very hard expression, a negative hallucination, you know, deleting a part of reality, a huge part of reality, and in this part of reality that is metaphorically speaking, outside the walls of our institutions, of our working places, and then you can found a world that is so different from what we used to see in with our patients and in our institutions. In that place, this sort of barbarian or barbaric world, which is a place where there are new, different rules, where you can find a lot of the evils that are undermining our societies, as racism, for mentioning something that I have write up a lot. And we've been pretending that this is something that we can handle with our usual psychoanalytical tools. I mean, as an individual pathology, this guy is racist because he has he's reacting to his vulnerability or hiplosigkeit, or this guy feels that he is discriminated and he's auto-discriminating himself because of, you know, something that happened with his family, his mother, his father, his Oedipus complex, or even the transference with the analyst, which is true, but it's not enough. If we don't link this with what's going on in the society as a whole and in our history, I think we are missing the point.
Are you making the point that, and I want to be careful about this because the distinctions are meaningful, that in the office, the traditional setting that you're perhaps attributing to a European setting or you call it a third world situation you're in, that there is so much, in the office, there's room for metaphor and symbolization because safety is assured. There isn't physical danger. There isn't an external crisis. There isn't chronic frightening overstimulation, all of which are associated with what we call trauma. But outside the office in your community, there is an overwhelming amount of trauma in the sense of survival. Survival is what's at issue. And therefore, the defensive structure, not to mention the physiological structure, is required to always be alert to the environmental overstimulation, and therefore to just think in terms of symbols and metaphoric meaning is to miss the level of necessity, the sympathetic overload that people live in chronically and physiologically. Is that a fair framing of what you're saying?
Yes, yes, I think it's fair, and only I want to stress the fact that whether we like it or not, whether we see it or not, this is happening inside the office, and it's inside the transference. And
tell me what you mean by that. Can you?
Yes. I am thinking of different kinds of patients. I don't know if this was sheer luck or unconsciously. I've been always trying to do this, to have patients from different socioeconomic layers. Mm-hmm. And actually, I do it right now. And you know, from the bottom to the upper side of society, and you know, when and you can see a lot of different phenomena that goes on there in transference, from the patient that comes from the upper classes, which is assuming that we think the same way and that we share the same values, and that we are in the same world, and they say things like I'm sure you know this person, and he mentions the person, things like that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Never happened with people from the lower classes, which are not assuming
sure.
anything like that, and which are, on the contrary, the phenomena that goes on there is quite different. But in all of this has to be worked through in the transference.
Meaning unpacking the assumptions that the person makes. The term was a sort of shared superiority that he's presuming in a defensive stance.
On the other side, the fact that this person is thinking, because this person comes from the, you can say, underworld sometimes,
yeah.
That this person is assuming that coming to my office is a way of saving himself, you know? I remember a patient many years ago who came from a small town in the Andes, and his father was the manager of a bank there, so he was considered white in his small town, and he was sure that he was white because, you know, his father was one of the important persons of the town. And when he came to Lima, very quickly he found out that he was not considered white here in Lima, that he was considered, you know, a cholo, how do you say mestizo in English,
mixed breed,
yes,
yeah.
And he was considered somebody who is in the lower part of society. So coming from the Andes to Lima, mm-hmm. also descending in the social ladder for him. And when he came to me, I managed to put this in on the table and say, yeah, but I belong to this world that I think I belong to this world that makes you feel that you are in a lower place. And he said, no, because I read what you write in the paper, and I know you are different. And, you know, he was denying the fact that he came to me. Enfin, those kind of situations, if you don't put them on the table, they can go on like if nothing sure. was going on there. And a lot is going on there. And then we start working something that was not. He was talking about his family, his problems with women or whatever, but he was not addressing this. So this happens all the time.
Sure.
It could be identification, you know, we are the same, you know, we belong to the same world, we think the same thing, or on the contrary, I have the hope that you that belong to this privileged place can help me to get out of this suffering, not because, not only as a psychoanalyst, because you are, you know, famous or whatever, because I'm very well known mm-hmm. here in my country as an intellectual and as a psychoanalyst. We'll talk about that later, because that could be very, very narcissistically gratificating, but it's also a problem. And if you don't address this, I think that the job is not well done. And I think it is not enough to use traditional psychoanalytical tools. You have to develop a different way of thinking in the first place, a different sensibility. And you have to try to work in these blind spots that many, many colleagues have, me too, of course, because it's very painful to speak about this. And you have to be disposed to be ready to go against the statu quo, what we think is, you know, normal in our society, because this has been happening for since the Spaniards came to Latin America. And the difference is that, for instance, in the United States, your problem, as I've already talked with you before, is with minorities. And here is, on the contrary, it's with majorities of the population. But it is true, these majorities don't usually come to the office. The money and not only money, you know, sometimes it's they just don't come because they don't feel comfortable coming to see a psychoanalyst, because psychoanalysis is seen as something that belongs to the elite and it's not available, not only because of money issues. A lot of social barriers are, there, and people don't see psychoanalysis as something that could help them. And I think this needs to be changed.
Let me ask you a question about this, because I want to try to understand it. What I heard you describing with the wealthy patient and the poor patient is that they both brought transference assumptions to the office.
Yes.
And you heard it. You had whatever personal reactions you had to receiving it, but that didn't pull you off of your attending to helping them get beyond it so the work could deepen. And you brought up whether it be the shared assumptions of the wealthy person or the idealization of the poor person who you sort of imply was going to, through your idealized position, was going to grant him something that he felt he didn't have, which is, to my ear, something we all do every day. Now, but you're saying, and this is where I need you to help me with it, you're saying, I think, that the importance of focusing on the cultural, social aspect is that you will be more readily attuned to pick these fantasies up and less attuned to, let's say, sharing what you call the narcissistic gratification of being related to as a shared special person. Do I have that right?
Oh, yes, you do. I agree. I want to emphasize that I think we cannot be I think we cannot continue, or we could, maybe would never do that work as psychoanalysts without a comprehension of our history and the particularities of our society. Every society, of course. Now,
sure.
I'm mm-hmm. talking about America, but everybody needs to do that. I've quoted before Leo Rangel and the great work he did in the Nixon era in the United States, which was a huge influence for me, because I thought, yes, that's the way. I mean, I like that.
Mm-hmm.
He was listening to his patients, and then he realized something is going on here. That we haven't been discussing our institutes or our congresses or whatever, no? And this is this identification with this perverse superego or whatever, and this pleasure in transgression and electing Nixon because he was a crook. And et cetera, et cetera. Something that we see here all the time. Now, while we speak, my country is in turmoil, for instance. No? And we are in a very, very convulsive situation. Nobody knows what's going to happen tomorrow, et cetera, et cetera. Can we still work without, taking this into account, like the you know, when the barbarians were outside Rome or outside whatever, you know, and people were discussing philosophers or whatever, and the Byzantine situation, you know?
Yeah, let me ask you about that. That's something we in the States have a great deal of experience with, where there's enormous political turmoil. I'm referring mostly to the Trump years. And the field of psychoanalysis was very involved, for lack of more precision, very involved with the disturbances that were associated with Trump and his group of people that he brought into power. The question that was often raised here, and I'm asking you how you manage it where you are, is how does one deal with pressing outside political factors in a way that honors what our job is? Our task as healers, as psychoanalysts, is to help the person become aware of who they are. And I don't want to draw too sharp a line between that and honoring barbarians at the gate, but it isn't so clear sometimes how one has a point of view. Do you bring the point of view in? What kind of patient, at what kind of moments, do you bring your own point of view or your own awareness of the outside political situation in, while keeping primary your goal, your function, which is to help the person have their own internal freedom?
Let me say that I followed very, very carefully, I continue to do it, the American situation with Donald Trump. I won't say I'm happy that happened, because I was very concerned, as everybody else in the world. True. But I was very happy that the analyst responds to this, and they didn't act as if nothing was going on, you know. Maybe because Trump was president and he was so visible and he took, I mean, I'm not going on there, but I was glad that the American psychoanalysts, not all of them, of course, took a stand there, mm-hmm. and did not ignore this, on the contrary. And not only they pronounced themselves, but also they were discussing this, and I don't know what happened in the private situation, in the intimacy of the office.
Right, that's the question. Sure,
Of course, but I'm guessing that this was not completely outside of the question. So that's a very good example, and. You know, we had this terrible history in European origins of psychoanalysis. No, what Freud did with the Nazi situation and the anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. Of course, I'm not going to blame him. He was so worried, tried to save our institution, and he actually did, but he could not do everything. And but I put him as an example of somebody who wasn't able to cope with this in his readings, right. Although he was so you know, prolific in the cultural issue, he never took this into, for instance, racism or anti-Semitism. And, well, we have to say that he left this work to our...
For us to do.
Yeah. Well, right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And, but yes, I think this has an impact, your situation, our situation in Latin America, in the job. And many of our colleagues, I think, are trying to preserve, and rightly so, in a sense, the purity of the psychoanalytical job, but there is a danger there. That's what I'm trying to understand. I'm not sure of this, of course. I'm just thinking and trying to open a conversation, because how did this impact in our job? I've quoted Lee Jaffe in 2019 apologies to the LGBT community. 2019, I mean, that's kind of late. It's, of course, better than never. But, I mean, we are some kind of impervious to this. No, we try to work without taking this into account. And even less without being, how could this impact in our thinking, in our also technique? I know you have that into your blog, but these are questions too complex for one guy to answer it. What I mean is that we cannot go on as we did before. And I think there is a growing sense of consciousness of this problem. Owen Rennick said sometime that neutrality is sheer fiction. And I like that. I mean, because we've been so long, getting behind neutrality, not to get involved in.
Right. And the challenge for us is, like we're talking, is to how do we take these ideas and how do we operationalize them? How do we bring them into the office? And can we demonstrate, one way or the other, that they deepen the patient's experience? Because that, to me, is what our pledge is. Our pledge is to the person who comes to us that we will do all we can to help them live more fully than they have known how to up to now. And it may very well be that the blind spot, as you call it, for cultural influences is an essential thing to fold into our approach and our understanding and our technique. It's just, as you say in your statement that I read earlier, they are separate ways of thinking, at least as what I hear you saying. That is, how we intervene with a patient, like your patients, you said, both the wealthy patients and the poor patient, we need to stay alert to the imaginings they bring to who we are. And in your case, you're a minority, you're the white analyst with the mixed person that you're seeing as a patient, and you're astute to what does that mean to him? What does it mean to him relying on cultural meanings? And what does it mean to him in terms of his fantasy meanings? He, especially because he went from being one of you, where he came from, quote unquote, to now not being one of you. So his intrapsychic life would be fascinating to help him get to know. Are there other cases that you want to mention that might shed some light on these challenges?
Yes, I'm afraid I have a bias there because I think I've learned more from people that come from different cultural entourage than mine than what I learned with people who come from the same entourage, same so to speak, because, you know, I'm not rich. And some of these people are very, very, very rich and they consider me as one of them. Just because I'm white and I live in a good neighborhood.
Another set of fantasies to unpack, right?
Exactly. And I have to. I remember once a patient who came from the rich social layers saying, you know, it's like if I had a Kia van, you know, the Kia is the Korean marker. And at that time, I had a Kia van, a Kia SUV, and I thought that was very funny. And I was thinking, how can I use this? No, because for him, you know, if you don't have a Mercedes or
you're degraded, right?
Yeah, you are degraded, right? The thing. Distinctions, as Pierre Bourdieu said in France, no, la distinction, how higher classes are always trying to difference from the middle classes, and they have to change clothes and cars and places and ways of speaking. And yes, but I learned more, I think, when listening to people that don't belong to my world. And that's when I can listen to things that are new for me. But maybe that's a blind spot. I recognize that. That I acknowledge that when I maybe I it's easy to get involved in the fantasy that we are doing our psychoanalytical job with people who have no kind of issues like that. Even though those persons, sooner or later, they are going to say something like, listen, I'm not a racist, but, you know, that's very, very often here in Peru. But this person acts in this way and he doesn't know how to eat or whatever, no? Or they don't use the proper words and so on and so forth. And but I was saying when I work with people that come from different social layers, especially low social layers, and there I can and maybe that's my blind spot, there I can listen more carefully and pointing. Fantasies or mechanism that interact with the social and cultural reality, which that's what I'm thinking all the time, is always there, always, whether we are conscious of it or not. It's always impacting in our interactions.
And it's our job to listen to it and how it lives between us in the office, yeah?
Right, exactly. Exactly. That's a hard job to do because we can easily go, you know, like any of Freud patients and go on.
And miss it, sure. Miss the fantasies and the whole internal life that lives as influenced by these cultural factors. But what we're talking about are people who end up in our offices, which, as you point out, is a very, very small number of people. And that speaks to your social outreach work. Tell us about, first of all, tell us about your newspaper column.
Yes. The title of the whole column is Asuntos Personales, Personal Issues. And which is ironic because they are never personal, they are always cultural and personal. And I try to do every week, I've just did it this morning in, you know, in the middle of this turmoil, always trying to use psychoanalysis in a very clear way so everybody can understand what I say, to help understand from a psychoanalytical perspective the social situation. For instance, our former president Pedro Castillo 2 days ago tried a ridiculous coup d'etat, which was obvious that was never going to work. And the day after, he said when some of his the person who works with him came to see him to the prison where he's now, and he said, I don't remember anything. I remember saying this discourse. And so I did a paper on of this. I think he's lying, of course, but there is kind of something is true there. He's just calling the void in his inner world because he was obviously incapable of holding this position as a president. He was there really by accident, and he was a totally outsider, but not an outsider like Trump, who, well, he's a very wealthy man and he's used to interact with powerful people, et cetera, et cetera. This was not the case of this person. And this void allowed, I would say, everybody to project on him. You know, he was, for instance, attacked by the far right as a donkey, as somebody who belongs to the Indians in the worst and most hateful meaning.
That same hierarchy we were talking about, that strict hierarchy of the powerful and the degraded, lives in so much of your reference to the cultural scene.
But at the same time, there was a huge 30% of people who knew that he was, you know, incompetent as a president, that he did nothing but stealing, but he did nothing for them, but they didn't care. Because, you know, the white elites hate him. So that was enough. You know,
And you wrote about that in your column.
I wrote about that in my column. This, for them, it was enough that he pissed off the white elites that did hate them. And they hate the white elites. So this you know, circle of negative feelings, Castillo was perfect for this because he was so, you know, he had so little ideas. The only thing he wanted to do was steal, and so everybody could project whatever he wanted in him. So and then I tried to write about this. That was this morning, and every week. And that's a good thing of not living in Switzerland, as we say here as a joke. You never get bored. Because every day...
Can you give us some other topics that you've written about for the column?
Yeah, sure. I've written about blind spots, for instance, or racism about Castillo, or how people in the Congress, which is dominated by the right... were so astonished that he has 30% of support when he was so bad as a president, because he was really, really maybe the worst one we have known in many, many years. And but he was supported because they feel identified with him, and that this idea was intolerable for the right wing of the politics in our country. So I wrote about that. Or there is always something that allows me to link psychoanalysis and social issues, and trying to do it in a very clear way. So that's my outreach work, so to speak. There's the only thing I can do, because there are a lot of specialists in politics and social issues here in Peru, which are very, very sharp and good and have studied in great universities, so have nothing to do to say that they could not say much better than me. But I have a very special take, which is psychoanalysis. So I try to do that all the time.
And has it been 28 years? Did I get that right?
Yeah, that's been 28 years. Yes, every week. You know, I don't know how it spent so long. When you asked me that question, I was thinking, well, that's a lot of time.
It's a lot of time. And Twitter, you have how many followers on Twitter?
Exactly, I have 300K.
300,000.
A little more. 330,000.
That's an enormous number. Right. You want to share your handle so we can add to your following list for our listeners?
The @, and then it's J Bruce. J is J in Spanish. JOTA Bruce. Like Bruce Lee.
Okay. Yes. All right. Jota so Bruce. So it's at J-O-T-E Bruce.
No, J-O-T-A.
J-O-T-A, sorry. Okay, we'll put it in the show notes so everybody could, I'm writing it down, everybody could sign up.
I just wanted to say that I don't do, so to speak, psychoanalysis in my Twitters.
I hope not.
In my tweets. Right, because yeah. If I do that, you know, it would simply won't work.
Of course. I understand.
Well, I do a lot of different things, politics, jokes, but trying now and then to put psychoanalysis there. And the people know me now. You know, I was saying that I'm well known here. So they know that I am a psychoanalyst. Mm. Without me saying specifically things, they know that I am speaking from a psychoanalytical point of view, mm-hmm. so to speak.
Jorge, we have a few minutes. Tell us about yourself, if you don't mind. You know, we all have our journeys, what brings us to where we are, and you hold a special place. Just to remind everybody that you will be a keynote speaker at the IPA meetings in Cartagena in July 2023, and there will be a link on the show notes where somebody could look into that and register for it. But you hold a special place in our field. You are both an analyst and also an analyst with the sensitivities and attentions that we're describing today to cultural, social matters. And you're also someone obviously very deeply involved in outreach. Can you help us get a feel for you, the person that has led you to this?
Yeah, thank you, Harvey. Let me try to do that. Since I remember, since I was a very small kid, maybe because I was shy and I was not, you know, the athletic kind of person, I was very interested in books and in writing. And I knew since the very beginning, if you can talk about a vocation, that I would be an intellectual. That was my first interest in life, books, writing, thinking. And what I didn't know was how I was going to which field was going to be my field of work. And I remember hesitating when I was in Peru in my university. You have 2 years of what we call humanities, and then you have to choose. And I was wondering philosophy, literature, psychology, and finally I chose psychology. And it was a wrong choice. I will be happier choosing literature or philosophy. My mm-hmm. daughter has choose that, and I know her teachers because they are my age, and I am her friends, and they are great people, very very interesting people. And psychology was very boring for me in the university. But then. Came a psychoanalyst who was my teacher in psychology, Saul Peña, who came from London. He still belongs to the independent group, and he was our first psychoanalyst. That was very late. That was in the year 71, 72. Late because in Argentina, psychoanalysis started in the 40s. In Peru, started in the 70s. And then I heard something that was completely different. And that interested me deeply. And that's how it started. And then I knew I wanted to be a psychoanalyst. And little by little, another people started to came all from England, Max Hernandez, Moises Lemlich, and lucky enough, they were all of them very interesting people, very very original. Not only because they were studying in England, but maybe because they choose to go away and you know, take the European adventure. And when they came back, they took different paths. But I'm still close to all of them. They're lucky enough; they are all alive. And And then I saw something that was appealing to me. And because I saw in psychoanalysis something that could help me or let me, you know, integrate different situations, my own experience as a person, you know, this shy boy from my life was also a little bit special because I spent my childhood in a small town in the north of Peru called Talara, which was a place where there was a lot of petroleum. And there was an American company, the Standard Oil Company, had a place there. It was like living in the United States. You know, we ate Snickers and candies and ice creams and things that. And the place was like any suburb in Philadelphia, with a lot of gardens, and you could let your bicycle everywhere. And it was a closed place. It was a fake place, but it was great to live there. I mean, it was so happy to be there. So,
could you explain the fake? I think I know what you mean, but tell me. I wouldn't have used the word or guessed the word
because it was a kind of paradise. Every time I found out one of my friends from that time, we always are nostalgic how beautiful our life was and how calm and how you know, anything you need, you have it. Our school was great. It was a mixed school, boys and girls. We were very little number of students, 7 or 8. We played baseball, rugby, things that we don't play in Peru.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that was very, very, in that sense, I say fake, but not in a pejorative way, because I remember this with a lot of, it warms my heart to think about that time.
You sound touched by it.
Half
our
friends were Americans.
Uh-huh.
So the word in Spanish is enclave. I don't know how you say that in English. You know, it's like the United States are very good doing this. They put America somewhere. It could be Germany or it could be Peru or it could be anywhere. No, they're you know, the Truman Show, you know? You remember that film, The Truman
Yes,
Show?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of a Truman Show. It was beautiful. It was great. Everybody was nice, and it was safe. And
you're also describing, I take it, I gather that you're not just describing the environment, but you're also referencing your family environment. Is that a correct assumption?
Yes, you are absolutely right. We were all very happy. I was very lucky with my family. We my parents are died now, but I have a great relationship with my sisters and my brother. And I was very lucky in that, in many sense. And there it was. This is funny because it was all closed. You know, it was kind of a
walled community kind of thing.
Exactly. And the social difference were not obvious. But I was an observing child anyhow. I remember this, for instance, the dogs. Everybody had a dog there because, you know, there was picket fences, everything like America, and a dog. And the doors were open. And the dogs were friendly, except... And this is very interesting. When, for instance, the gardener came walking by in his bicycle, and then the dogs became aggressive. And I said, this is very strange. Why the dogs are aggressive against only people that don't belong to this place? Mm-hmm. You know, animals can be very interesting. I remember this idea very clearly. This was my first hint that something was wrong here. Then, of course, I started understanding when I get out of there. No? But when you were there, it was really, really, as I said, the Truman Show, you know, a place that was completely built so people can feel that they were absolutely not in touch with the outer world.
Right.
So, yes, I guess that had to do with my interest in not believing everything you see around and try to go beyond. And I think Freud was great in doing this, even though he had blind spots, as everybody does.
But it's not just the surface, there's the depth.
Yes, yes. So that was that. So when I came to the university in Lima, I did something very, very interesting too. I was in the Catholic University, which is, you know, the greatest university in Peru. And at the same time, when I was already in psychology, and I say it was very boring for me, I started to study philosophy in San Marcos. San Marcos is a national university. La Católica is a private university. And at that time, it was only for the upper classes. Now it has changed, which is great. But San Marcos, it was and it's still a very popular place because it's free. But it was a good university. But it was very, very Marxist at that time. So Marxist that I had to quit 2 years after because, you know, the classes were always interrupted and there were always strikes. It was... You know, it's a very, very, very turbulent situation, and I was at, but I spent 2 years that were very, very interesting for me. But I had to say this: I didn't make many friends. I tried to, but they didn't accept me. And that was a great lesson for me too. I mean, they didn't like me, and that, of course, it was painful, and I was not. I didn't feel good about this, but I learned a lot about this. Later on, I was a teacher there, and it was not easy. But
I can imagine.
I wanted to do that. So you can have an idea of how things can be so contrast. The contrast here is really terrible. I know in the States you have similar problems, but not the same kind.
The hierarchy you describe, and I have spent some time throughout Latin America, and I have been struck by the rigidity and the seemingly absolute quality of the hierarchy. And we obviously have our hierarchies here in the States, but they have a different style to them, I would say. And I think you're bringing your sensibility from where you come from, as well as integrating it with your time in Europe, it has been and will continue to teach us a great deal about how one has to listen to the environment and how one has to listen to the internal as it lives in the office and how we make sense of how they combine so that we can do our work both, as the saying goes, on and off the couch. Jorge, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for being here, for sharing, for your writings, which I have begun immersing myself in and enjoying. And I look forward to hearing you go further into this in the meetings in July in Cartagena. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much, Harvey. It was very, very useful for me to talk with you, to answer your questions, and I'm happy that you have a podcast, and I'm happy that this is changing, and I hope our colleagues will start to work a lot more in this borders that we think that they are so rigid as our hierarchies. And I think they are not. I think they are all the time, moving, and we are a lot more contaminated than we think.
I would say influenced. How about influenced?
Influenced. Okay.
Yeah.
Influence is a very good word.
Thanks again.
Thank you, Harvey.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.